Greetings in the name of Christ. It's great to be with you again this morning. Why don't we take our Christian hymnals, our church hymnals, and turn to number 633. Number 633. Could I have an E flat on that, Andy, please?
Shall we gather at the river where bright angel feet have trod? We his crystal type forever, flowing by the throne of God. You've been down at the river, the beautiful, washing up his silver spray. We will walk and worship ever all the happy golden day. Yes, we'll gather at the river, the beautiful
And won't that be a wonderful day? Today is Mother's Day. We've already heard some about mothers, and I really appreciated that. But I'm going to speak a bit more about mothers. I'd like to talk about mothers today, about parenting, about families. And maybe I'm, you know, we're all limited to our perspectives. Our insights are limited to our perspectives. And I'm 33, so I do not have the perspective of that some of you have. As older than me, and I respect that, but there's really, I can take advice from you, but some of those things you only learn the hard way. And so I'm not going to try to make profound statements from what will be, from what is your perspective. I'm going to try to talk from what the way I see, from where I am this morning. Although we can always take the perspective of the Word of God, and that's always something that we can stand on. But, you know, whenever we speak of mothers, we tend to to wax eloquent. That's where people even with normally plebeian minds tend to become ecstatic when they speak of their mothers. And motherhood is a beautiful thing. I did notice, looking for quotes and things, that many of the quotes that speak the highest of mothers and of what they do have been written by men. And, you know, I think one thing that is maybe closed to the perspective of man is just the actual grittiness of motherhood. Motherhood is a beautiful thing, and a wise woman who trains her children well and is a good wife and mother that's something that is absolutely beautiful. But there's something that is closed off from man, and that is what actually some of the nuts and bolts of that is, I think. And I think men will never truly understand some of the heartache, some of the reality of what it goes into being a mother. And I think maybe that's why the men just have to stand back in awe and praise God for what a godly mother is. And the reason I chose that song this morning, "Shall We Gather at the River," is I think maybe what gives vision and purpose to mothers, to godly mothers. Because, you know, really at the end of the day, when everything comes down to the realities, we're going to meet at the river. Mothers and their children, fathers and their children, families, grandparents, we're going to meet there someday. And, you know, things can become a drudgery. The minutiae of daily life can become a tapestry of drudgery unless we have focus and vision. And the little things can eat us up unless we have that vision. Someday, we're going to meet at the river. What am I doing right now to make sure that meeting, in which I'm going to stand alone before God, but in a way I'm going to stand there with my family, that's a joyous meeting? And, you know, part of what is the heartache or the terror, I think, that grips parents, fathers and mothers alike, as godly parents, is, will my children make the right choice? Because, you know, we cannot choose for our children. We can set the stage. We can do everything in our power, but we cannot make our children's choices. We're raising our children for a future that we will never see. Trying to the best of our ability to equip them for circumstances that we ourselves have no way of knowing and understanding. It's a huge responsibility. It's a terrifying responsibility. And yet we can have confidence that if we do it God's way, God's going to take care of them, just as he takes care of us. So many things, so many questions, so many ways to go wrong. But the beauty of it is that God gives us a clear way to go right. And so I'd like to look at a few examples of that this morning. The other day, just before Sister Clara left to go up with her family up north, she actually invited a couple of us over to her house, and we had the very great privilege of having supper over there. And I was just glancing through some of the things that she had in her library, and I came across this in one of her scrapbooks, and I thought it just fit her to a T. But I also think it fits many of the women here. It fits my wife. It fits my mother. And I think it's something that should be, that is beautiful to see. And it's simply called "A Strong Woman Versus a Woman of Strength." It says, "A strong woman works out every day to keep her body in shape, but a woman of strength kneels in prayer to keep her soul in shape. A strong woman isn't afraid of anything But a woman of strength shows courage in the midst of her fear. A strong woman won't let anyone get the best of her, but a woman of strength gives the best of her to everyone. A strong woman makes mistakes and avoids the same in the future, but a woman of strength realizes life's mistakes can also be God's blessings and capitalizes on them. A strong woman walks sure-footedly, but a woman of strength knows God will catch her when she falls. A strong woman wears the look of confidence on her face, but a woman of strength wears grace. A strong woman has faith that she is strong enough for the journey, but a woman of strength has faith that it is in the journey that she will be made strong. I'm going to also read something of G.K. Chesterton. To be Queen Elizabeth within a definite area, deciding sales, banquets, labors, and holidays, to be Whiteley, obviously this is written by a British man, within a certain area, providing toys, boots, cakes, and books, to be Aristotle within a certain area, teaching morals, manners, theology, and hygiene, I can imagine how this can exhaust the mind, but I cannot imagine how it could narrow it. How can it be a large career to tell other people about the rule of three, and a small career to tell one's own children about the universe? How can it be broad to be the same thing to everyone, and narrow to be everything to someone? No, a woman's function is laborious, but because it is gigantic, not because it is minute. So that's a beautiful calling. I think maybe sometimes, though, we men tend to think, well, I've got a terrific wife, which I do, thank the Lord, who is a terrific mother, which she is, thank the Lord. And that sort of absolves me. You know, I can sort of do my thing. I just let her do the parenting, and I make the money. Nothing could be further from the truth. So a lot of the principles that apply to mothers, I think, definitely need to apply to men as well. We cannot be absolved of our responsibility of parenting. Mothers have a place that we simply cannot take. But we have likewise a place that they cannot take. And let's both take up our responsibility. Okay, I'd like to look at a few examples in the Bible of mothers. And let's start with 1 Samuel, chapter 1. And I'm not going to read this all. I'll read sections of it, but we'll skip over part of it and I'll just tell it. There was a man whose name was Elkanah, and he had two wives, which caused him some grief there. That's not necessarily an ideal arrangement. But anyway, this man had, well, obviously not an ideal arrangement, one which I would in no way endorse. But this man had two wives, and they would go up every year to worship at Shiloh, where the tabernacle was. And he really loved his wife Hannah. She was very, very dear to him. And it's interesting that when it came time to sacrifice, he gave her a double portion. But Hannah had one great grief. She was barren. She could not bear children. And it's her adversary, the Bible calls her, the other wife, Peninnah, provoked her and egged her on and really lorded it over her. It made life very difficult for her. And it says in verse 8, then said Elkanah, her husband, to her, Hannah, why weepest thou, and why eatest thou not? Why is the heart grieved? And then he says something that a typical man would say, am I not better to thee than 10 sons? We mean well often, but sometimes we don't say the right thing. Because there's something there that only a child can take the place of for a woman, and men, we just have to accept that. But, you know, even though he loved her, you know, sometimes we make mistakes, and let's not hold us against each other. But Hannah rose up, it says very early, and she went to pray. And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto the Lord and wept sore. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me and forget not thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. What a promise. And can we make the same promise as parents, that our children are to be given to the Lord. That whatever happens, that's going to be our focus. Our focus is on the river. We're going to give our children to the Lord. We can get caught up in the ABCs and the learning your math and learning how to behave yourself and all these things, and it can merely become something that we're doing. Are we giving our children to the Lord? And you know the story how Eli came upon her there and he thought she was drunk and made life difficult for her, but when he understood what was going on, he gave her a promise that she would bear a child. And one thing that I really wanted to think about Hannah here is that she only had Samuel at home for a very, very short period of time. And then she went through completely with her promise. It wasn't something that was symbolic. She gave Samuel to the Lord. As soon as he was able to, maybe at the age of six, as he was able to live by himself, she took him to the tabernacle and there he stayed. A very, very short time that she was with him. And you know, we as parents have a longer time to be with our children, but it's still very short. And what are we doing? We're just putting in time and expecting them to turn out okay, or are we taking it very seriously? I saw a breakdown here recently that said if you think you have a lot of time with your children, you've got 18 years or 20 years or whatever it is. He said, think of it this way. You've got a newborn for a month. You've got an infant for about 6 months. And then you've got a baby for a year and a half. Then you've got a toddler for 2 years. And if you break it down, it's actually very short periods of time at which we have these children. And are we making use of it? Sometimes we've got the best of intentions as parents. But sometimes being a good parent just comes down to a matter of math. Our best intentions aren't any good to the children if we're not around to implement them. All right? Motherhood is a great honor and privilege, yet it is also synonymous with servanthood. Every day, women are called upon to selflessly meet the needs of their families, whether they are awake at night, nursing a baby, spending their time and money on less than grateful teenagers, or preparing meals. Moms continuously put others before themselves. And I think that's something that's good for teenagers to remember, and also the dads who come grumpily home after a big day of work. Another quote, a mother is a person who, seeing there are only four pieces of pie for five people, promptly announces she never did care for pie. Now, parents need to learn to work as a team. This is very important. Conflict between parents can render meaningless a lot of what you are trying to teach to your children. And double standards and power plays kill respect, something that we need to remember. If I tell my children that they need to act one way, they need to keep their anger in check and yet act angry when they don't, I'm nullifying my own teaching. What are some traits that good parents share? Not just mothers, but fathers as well. I think one thing that's important is that we are whole people ourselves. Some parents rely on their children to meet their emotional needs. And that's something that may sound good, that our life is our children. But I don't think it should be. Our life needs to be more than just about our families. It needs to be about the Lord and about having a vision for his work in our lives. And it's not unless that is that way that our children can catch that vision ourselves through us. I think it's important that good parents are emotionally balanced, that we're not wildly moving from one spectrum to the other. But, you know, on the other hand, too, I think children have a sophisticated ability to know when parents are truly trying. And sometimes parents can really beat themselves up for mistakes and maybe Maybe we should just be more honest with ourselves and with our children, because I think children understand when you're trying to do your best. I think it's important that parents are both teachable and teachers. We're the ones that are supposed to be in charge. And when we get emotionally distraught, when our three-year-old is acting the way he shouldn't be, then we're not being the adult. We need to be emotionally balanced ourselves. Okay, let's turn over to Exodus now. A similar story, if you think about it, to the one we just read. Exodus chapter 1. While we're turning there, here's another quote. Being a full-time mother is one of the highest salary jobs in my field, since the payment is pure love. Okay, Exodus 1. In this first chapter, the king of Egypt had a problem. The Israelites, the Hebrews, were growing strong, and they began to be fearful that if there was ever a war, that the Hebrews would rise up against them. And so they began a systematic decimation of the Hebrew population, killing off the Hebrews, the babies. So he commanded the midwives that were there at the births to kill any baby boy that was born. Well, that didn't work. So in verse 22, Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, "Every son that is born, you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." So if an Egyptian soldier is walking along and he spots a new baby, he was to cast it into the river Nile. And I'm sure this was just a terrible time for the Hebrews. But let's start reading here in chapter 2. "And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to his wife a daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived and bare a son. And when she saw him that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could no longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein. And she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. Now his sisters stood afar off, to wit, what would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river. And her maidens walked along by the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. When she had opened it, she saw the child. And behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him and said, 'This is one of the Hebrews' children.' Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, 'Shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee?' And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Go.' And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, 'Take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages.' And the woman took the child and nursed it. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses, because I drew him out of the water." Okay. Once again, a woman who had very little control over the life of her child after a very short period. But where Hannah was sending Samuel off to a good environment, there were challenges there at the tabernacle with Eli's sons, but it was a better environment. Moses' mother is sending him off to the pagans, and talk about a terrible environment. And once again, a very short period of time to train him up in. How did she do it? What must have been those long evenings when she was talking with Moses? I don't know. But you know, one thing I think it is important to teach children is their own responsibility. That when they're away from us, that they're responsible before God. I think it's important that we keep from raising children who have a sense of entitlement, who are who expect everything to be done for them. An inflated sense of self-importance, uniqueness, and worthiness of applause is not a productive trait. Ego is not an indication of skill or maturity. So it's important that we build our children up, but it's also important that we don't just give them nothing but ego. And any time that there is a relationship in which you have a mature person and an immature person, the it's important that the mature person directs that relationship. And one thing that is important, I think, as parents, is that we allow our children to experience the joy that comes by sacrifice and giving to others. That we aren't just a perennial Santa Claus giving them whatever their heart desires with nothing required from them. Parents who never allow their children to sacrifice or to feel true responsibility keep them from growing. And it's interesting that the best parents are the ones that when their children grow up, they need them the least. That the children need the parents the least. And that is, I think, from my limited perspective, has got to be one of the hardest things in the world, is to pour your life into your child and then let them go. Emotionally, let them free. But without that trait in our parenting, we're limiting God's work in our children. One thing I think that maybe as young people, we tend to do too much. There's a stage we go through where our parents are absolutely the neatest people in the world. And if I remember a conversation in school in which a certain father had stated something that was different in the encyclopedia. The encyclopedia was misprinted. It was wrong. And there's no question that dad is right. When dad says something, it's right. Or when mom, the way the mom does it, it's the perfect way to do it. We go through that stage, and that's a beautiful stage. We eventually enter this stage in which everything is suspect, must be proven. And one thing that happens is that when a parent shows an imperfection, it gives us immediate excuse to disrespect them or to go against what they have. Nothing should be further from the truth. Parents are normal human beings, just like you. They accept and work with your faults. The same should be the case for us. Parental imperfections are normal, not the exception. Or excuse to be disrespectful. One thing I think that parents struggle with sometimes, Christian parents, is this thing of balancing, and it shouldn't be a balancing act, I don't believe, but balancing the Lord's work and family life. Sometimes, quite honestly, we have a lot going on in church, and we have to choose, am I going to put my family first, or am I going to go to yet another church function? And I haven't completely navigated those waters yet myself. But one thing I think it is important in that question is that we don't have to put either or with that. I think it's a beautiful thing when parents involve their children in the Lord's work. And if there's something to do, they take their children along and they show them how it's done. If there's somebody that needs help, the children show up and help rake the leaves too. I think that's important that they can see that happening. When the parents involve the whole family in the vision. Another thing that's important in good parents is patience. Girls, when you've got your dolls, you know how they cry sometimes, and then you put them to bed and everything's good again. Or maybe you paddle their plastic selves and they're good again. It doesn't really work that way when it's real children. They act in obstinate and interesting ways. And patience is a huge thing. And just be patient, I'll say it that way. Let's just be patient, but patient with a vision. I don't think children should walk over their parents. But sometimes things take time. And don't become discouraged. But above all, we must have love for God. We must have a real relationship with Him. And I don't feel comfortable when people just adulate a certain person. But I will say that there were many times I remember coming across my mother in prayer for us children. And she wasn't doing it to be seen of us, but I would just come on her maybe in the sewing room or something like that, and she would be in prayer for us. And you know, when the chips were down and it was conflict time, I remember those times. And you know, if we have the stage set in that way, it cannot be argued that we don't have our children's best interests at heart. I knew very well that my mother loved me and had my best interests at heart. It's important also that parents learn how to say no and mean it, and yet have empathetic authority, not something where we rule with a rod of iron, but yet know how to say no. One thing I think that maybe in America we are specifically cursed with or blessed with is this a symptom of what they call helicopter parenting, where we just hover over our children and you know, we want to do everything for them. We want to give them all the opportunities that we could possibly can. And one thing I think that is important is that we know when to intervene and when to let our children have room to make mistakes and things like this. And so I'm just saying that's a trait of a good parent. I'm not saying where that line is, but I do think that is something we need to let our children do, have the room to make mistakes. Proverbs 22, verse 6 says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." Part of training up a child is actually experiencing, training up a child to experience God is to experience him ourselves. And it's illogical, I think, to assume that we can allow things in our lives that are a double standard and then expect our children to take those things seriously. It's illogical to allow your teenager, who's not a member of the church yet, to dress in ways that a church member would not, simply because he or she is not a part of the church yet, and expect him or her to develop any kind of convictions for those things. What, are they supposed to magically change their mind as soon as they join the church? I think that's immature thinking. Are we interested in raising young adults with a vision for God's work? Or are we more interested in superficial compliance and rule bending? You know, the standards that we have in church, the standards that we place in our homes for our children, are just like guardrails. And I know that's said so often, it's almost a cliche, but don't grind along the guardrails. That's not what they're there for. If you take your car and just simply nose it over against the guardrail and keep on driving, you're going to go along, but you're going to get awfully beat up. You're going to, it's going to be very difficult for you. Keep on the road. Keep on the road to God. There's work to be done. There's souls to be saved. There are hurting people all around you. God is calling you. Turn toward him. And if we keep that kind of a focus, I'm convinced that will help our children also find the right focus and not spend their time simply grinding along the guardrails. Another thing I think that parents tend to do if they don't watch it is that they want children to see only by the light that they see. Only the light that they have experienced in their lives is as far as they want their children to see. I think it's important that as parents we try to light our children's fires. Now hopefully the road that we are following to God is that we are convinced that it is the right road, or it is a right road to God. And yet, teach them to find God. Teach them to look for God. Don't teach them only to look at our road. God is present in the details. Small miracles every day. And as a young parent, I'm in that stage where we get these beautiful little statements made all the time, and we can tend to become to talk about this quite a bit. But there are small moments of praise and wonder every day. Take time to see those from another perspective. And I know mothers especially, sleep deprived and weary sometimes those things can become difficult. And we can make it, as fathers and husbands, we can make it a lot tougher for them. Or we can make it a lot easier for them as well. Life can be an adventure to be enjoyed, or it can be simply an obstacle to overcome. I was talking with one of my friends the other day on the phone. Hadn't talked to him in, oh my, probably 5 or 6 years. And he's a young father, as am I. And he said, you know, that it's just so neat. He said, life beats you down. And you know, it really does. There's a reason I finally have figured out that people of a certain age begin to look a certain age. Life beats you down. But he said, there's nothing like going home. And you open the door and your children come running out and suddenly you're the hero again. And everything's all right. And that's the kind of refuge that children need to have, and I think in a real way parents have as well. And that's the kind of environment that we long for. Sometimes, though, we have to choose present conflict to avoid future problems. And, you know, I think we need to husband those times, choose our battles. But there comes a time at which we have to choose conflict as parents. And if, as parents, we simply try to push, to keep on kicking the ball on ahead and not confront our children about issues, you're going to experience future disaster, I'm convinced. Men, let's build up our wives. Make it easier for her. Lift her up. Don't push her down. And, you know, sometimes I think when we're in public, we're invited over somewhere, we've got company or something like that, it's almost like a game that husbands play sometimes, and it's really cruel, where we say jokes in a way that puts our wife in a bad light. Let's not do that. Let's build her up and put her in the place that God has put her in. We shouldn't live in the past. Men also have a tendency to say, well, my mother did it this way. And, you know, that's great if you experienced a wonderful family life as a child. But don't live in the past. And don't live in the future either. But live the present with an eye toward the future with the wisdom from the past. The other thing that we have to remember is that the Bible doesn't only give advice for parenting in ideal circumstances. When the husband's doing his thing, the wife's doing her thing, and the children are all little angels. It gives examples in times when parenting was difficult, in hard circumstances. It's important that we do what is right at all times, even when it is difficult. No excuses. Now, whenever there's a huge crime, like a school shooting or some terrible thing like this, people go back in to the lives of the people who were involved or who committed the crime, and they begin to pick the lives apart, and they say, aha, this is why this person did that. And, you know, we can all come up for excuses and reasons for why we don't, why we're not living the way we should. But there really is no excuse. The Bible says, the Bible gives us our roadmap whether or not we're in ideal circumstances or no. Here's another quote I thought was pretty good. You know the quote by Abraham Lincoln, although many quotes are attributed to Abraham Lincoln, which actually aren't. But this one is slightly modified. It says, you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool mom. I think that's true as well. Another one is, any mother could perform the jobs of several air traffic controllers with ease. Once again, these things just fit perfectly a lot of the time. I know, because a lot of us were the airplanes. Okay. I'd like to turn now to Luke 2. We've already read from Luke 2. But in closing, I'd like to look at Luke 2, just briefly, and look at something here in Mary's life. Okay. I'd like to start reading here at verse 15. It came to pass, as the angels were gone away from them into heaven, the shepherds said one to another, "Let us now go even unto Bethlehem and see this thing which has come to pass, which the Lord hath made known unto us." And they came with haste and found Mary and Joseph and the babe lying in a manger. And when they had seen it, they made known abroad the saying which was told them of them concerning this child. And all they that heard it wondered at those things which were told them by the shepherds. But Mary kept all these things and pondered them in her heart. And also jump down here to verse 34. And Simeon blessed them and said unto Mary his mother, "Behold, this child is set for the rising, fall and rising again of many in Israel, and for a sign which shall be spoken against. Yea, a sword shall pierce through thine own soul also, that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed." I think, once again in closing, there are things that we as men merely guess at in the hearts of a mother. And I'm so thankful that God blessed me with a wife that is a wonderful mother to my children, and also with a mother that did her best for us. And I think it's right that we honor you, and God bless you for all the work that you do. And just know that you are an essential part of God's kingdom, and there is no greater calling, I don't believe, than that which you have. There's a quote that I really like it. It says, "Educate a man, and you educate a person. Educate a woman, you educate a nation." And in a real way, a mother has the hearts of her children forever. And in that way, you have a huge impact beyond anything, any one event that you may have in their children's lives. Let's kneel for prayer.